Allie. Allie pulls herself up onto the tomb, leans back to look at the name. She always takes a moment to remember them. Hey, how are you doing there, Annabeth Macduff, loving mother now at rest? And lights a Marlborough. Cigarettes being among the 4,000 or 5,000 pleasures of this world that Mrs. Montgomery Taylor considers abhorrent in the sight of the Lord. Just the glowing embers, the inhalation, the stream of smoke from her parted lips would be enough to say, "Screw you, Mrs. Montgomery Taylor. Screw you and the ladies of the church and Jesus fucking Christ, too." It would have been enough to do it the usual way. Impressive enough, and a sufficient promise to the boys of things that might come to pass right soon. But Allie doesn't care to light her cigarette the usual way. Kyle gestures with his chin and says, "Heard a bunch of guys killed a girl in Nebraska last week for doing that." "For smoking? Harsh." Hunter says, "Half the kids in school know you can do it." "So what?" Hunter says, "Your dad could use you in his factory. Save money on electricity."
"He's not my dad."
She makes the silver flicker at the ends of her fingers again. The boys watch. As the sun sets, the cemetery comes alive with crickets and frogs calling, waiting for rain. It's been a long, hot summer. The earth yearns for a storm. Mr. Montgomery Taylor owns a meatpacking company with centres here in Jacksonville and up in Albany and as far as Statesboro. They call it meatpacking, but what they mean by that is meat producing, animal killing. Mr. Montgomery Taylor took Allie to see it when she was younger. He had that stage when he liked to think of himself as a good man, educating a little girl in the men's world. It's a sort of pride to her that she watched the whole thing without wincing, or looking away, or carrying on. Mr. Montgomery Taylor's hand was on her shoulder like a pair of pincers throughout the visit, pointing out to her the pens where the pigs are herded before their encounter with the knife. Pigs are very intelligent animals. If you frighten them, the meat doesn't taste so good. You've got to be careful. Chickens are not intelligent. They let her watch the chickens being uncrated, white and feather fluff. The hands pick them up, turn them over to show their snowy behinds, and shackle their legs into the conveyor, which drags their heads through an electrified water bath. They squawk and wriggle. One by one they go rigid, then limp.
"It's a kindness," says Mr. Montgomery Taylor. "They don't know what's hit them."
And he laughs, and his employees laugh too. Allie noticed that one or two of the chickens had raised their heads. The water hadn't stunned them. They were still awake as they passed along the line, still conscious as they entered the scalding tank.
"Efficient, hygienic, and kind," said Mr. Montgomery Taylor.
Allie thought of Mrs. Montgomery Taylor's ecstatic speeches about hell, and about the whirling knives and the scalding water that will consume your whole body, boiling oil and rivers of molten lead. Allie wanted to run along the line and pop the chickens out of their shackles and set them free, wild and angry. She imagined them coming for Mr. Montgomery Taylor in particular, taking their revenge in beaks and claws. But the voice said to her,
"This is not the time, daughter. Your moment has not come."
The voice has never led her wrong yet, not all the days of her life. So Allie nodded and said,
"It's very interesting. Thank you for bringing me."
It wasn't long after her visit to that factory that she noticed this thing she could do. There was no urgency in it. It was like the day she noticed her hair had gotten long. It must have been happening all that time, quietly. They were at dinner. Allie reached for her fork, and a spark jumped from her hand. The voice said,
"Do it again. You can make that happen again. Concentrate.
She gave a little twist or a flick of something in her chest. There it was, a spark.
Good girl, said the voice. But don't show them. This is not for them.
Mr. Montgomery Taylor didn't notice, and Mrs. Montgomery Taylor didn't notice. Allie kept her eyes down and her face impassive. The voice said,
This is the first of my gifts to you, daughter. Learn to use it.
She practiced in her bedroom. She made a spark jump from hand to hand. She made her bedside lamp glow brighter, then dimmer. She burned a tiny hole in a Kleenex. She practiced until she could make that hole a pinprick, smaller. These things demand constant focused attention. She's good at that. She's never heard of anybody else who can light their cigarettes with it. The voice said,
There will be a day to use this, and on that day, you will know what to do.
Usually, she'd let the boys touch her if they wanted. That's what they think they've come to this graveyard for. A hand sliding up the thigh, a cigarette popped from the mouth like candy, held to one side while there's kissing. Kyle props himself up next to her, puts his hand on her midriff, starts to bunch the fabric of her top. She stops him with a gesture. He smiles.
Come on now, he says.
He tugs her top up a little. She stings him on the back of the hand. Not a lot. Just enough to give him pause. He pulls his hand back, looks at her, and aggrieved at Hunter.
Hey, what gives?
She shrugs.
Not in the mood.
Hunter comes to sit on the other side of her. She's sandwiched between them now, both their bodies pressing in on her, bulges in their pants showing their minds.
That's fine, says Hunter, but see, you brought us here, and we are in the mood.
He lays an arm across her midriff, his thumb grazing her breast, his hand large and strong around her.
Come on, he says. We'll have some fun, just the three of us.
He comes in for a kiss, his mouth opening. She likes Hunter. He's 6'4". His shoulders are broad and strong. They've had fun together.
That's not what she's here for. She has a feeling about today.
She gets him in the armpit, one of her pinpricks, right into the muscle, precise and careful, like a fine-bladed knife, up through to his shoulder. She increases it, like making the lamp glow hotter and hotter, like the knife is made of flame.
Fuck!
Says Hunter, and jumps backwards.
Fuck!
He's holding his right hand into his left armpit, massaging it. The left arm is trembling. Kyle's angry now and pulls her towards him.
What did you make us come all the way out here for then? If you...
She gets him across the throat, just under the jaw, like a metal blade slicing across his voice box. His mouth falls slackly open. He makes choking sounds. He's still breathing, but he can't speak.
Fuck you then,
shouts Hunter.
You don't get a ride home.
Hunter backs away. Kyle gathers up his school bag, still holding his throat.
Ugh, you!
He shouts as they walk back to their car. She waits there for a long time after it gets dark, lying back on the grave of Annabeth Macduff, loving mother now at rest, lighting cigarette after cigarette with the crackle from her fingertips and smoking them down to the hilt. The noise of the evening rises up around her and she thinks, Come and get me. She says to the voice,
Hey, Mom. It's today, right?
The voice says,
Sure is, daughter. You ready?
Allie says,
Bring it.
She climbs up the trellis to get back into the house. Her shoes are slung around her neck,
shoelaces tied together. She digs her toes in, and her fingers hook on and grab. Mrs. Montgomery Taylor saw her once when she was younger scaling a tree. 1, 2, 3, up she went and said,
"Would you look at that? She climbs just like a monkey."
She said it like she'd long suspected this would be the case. Like she'd just been waiting to find out. Allie reaches her bedroom window. She'd left it open just a crack, and she pushes the jamb up, takes her shoes from around her neck and throws them inside. She levers herself through the window. She checks her watch. She's not even late for supper, and there'll be nothing for anyone to complain about. She lets out a sort of laugh, low and croaking. And a laugh meets her in return. And she realizes there's someone else in the room. She knows who it is, of course. Mr. Montgomery Taylor unfolds himself from the easy chair like one of the long-armed machines from his production line. Allie draws breath. But before she can form half a word, he's hit her very hard across the mouth backhanded. Like a tennis swing at the country club, the pop of her jaw is the thunk of the ball hitting the racket. His particular kind of rage has always been very controlled, very quiet. The less he says, the angrier he is. He's drunk. She can smell it. And he's furious. And he mutters,
"Sawyer. Sawyer in the graveyard with those boys. Filthy little whore."
Each word punctuated with a punch or a slap or a kick. She doesn't roll into a ball. She doesn't beg him to stop. She knows it only makes it go on longer. He pushes her knees apart. His hand is at his belt. He's going to show her what kind of a little whore she is. As if he hadn't shown her many times in the past. Mrs. Montgomery Taylor sits downstairs listening to the polka on the radio, drinking sherry, slowly but unceasingly. Little sips, which couldn't do no one any harm. She doesn't care to see what Mr. Montgomery Taylor does up there in the evenings. At least he's not cadding around the neighbourhood. And that girl earned what she's getting. If an interviewer from the Sun-Times, taking an interest for some reason in the small doings of this little home, had placed a microphone to her mouth at that moment and said, "Mrs. Montgomery Taylor, what do you think your husband is doing to that 16-year-old mixed race girl you took into your house out of Christian charity? What do you think he's doing to make her holler and carry on like that?" If she were asked, but who would ever ask, she'd say, "Why, he's giving her a spanking, and it's no more than she deserves." And if the interviewer pressed, "What did you mean then about his catting around?" Mrs. Montgomery Taylor's mouth would twist a little, as if she'd caught an odour of something unpleasant, and then the smile would return to her face, and she'd say, confidentially, "You know how men are." It was some other time, years ago, when Allie was pressed back, head cricked against the headboard, his one hand around her throat like this, that the voice first spoke to her, clearly, right inside her own head. When she thinks on it, she'd been hearing it distantly for a long time. Since before she came to the Montgomery Taylors. Since she passed from home to home and hand to hand, there's been a dim voice far away telling her when to be careful, warning her against danger. The voice had said, "You are strong. You will survive this." And Allie had said, as he tightened his grip on her neck,
"Mom?"
And the voice had said,
"Sure."
Nothing special has happened today. No one can say she was provoked more than usual. It is only that every day one grows a little. Every day something is different. So that in the heaping up of days, suddenly a thing that was impossible has become possible. This is how a girl becomes a grown woman. Step by step, until it is done. As he plunges, she knows that she could do it. That she has the strength, and perhaps she has had it enough for weeks or months, but only now is she certain. She can do it now, and leave no possibility of misfires or reprisals. It seems the simplest thing in the world, like reaching out a hand and flicking off a light switch. She cannot think why she hasn't decided to turn out this old light before. She says to the voice, "It's now, isn't it?" The voice says, "You know it." There is a smell like rain in the room, so that Mr. Montgomery Taylor looks up, thinks that the rain has started at last, that the parched earth is drinking it in great gulps. He thinks it might be coming in through the window, but his heart is gladdened by the thought of rain, even as he continues with his business. Ally brings her hands to his temples, left and right. She feels the palms of her mother around her own small fingers. She is glad Mr. Montgomery Taylor is not looking at her, but instead out through the window, searching for the non-existent rain. She maketh a channel for the thunderbolt, and setteth a path for the storm. There is a flash of white light, a flicker of silver across his forehead and around his mouth and his teeth. He spasms and pops out of her. He is juddering and fitting, his jaws are clattering together, he falls to the floor with a loud thump, and Ally is afraid that Mrs. Montgomery Taylor might have heard something. But she has the radio turned up loud, so there is no foot on the stair, no voice calling. Ally pulls up her underwear and her jeans. She leans over to watch. There is a red foam at his lips. His spine is curled backwards, his hands held like claws. It looks like he's still breathing, she thinks. I could call someone now and maybe he'd live. So she puts her palm over his heart and gathers the handful of lightning she has left. She sends it into him right there, in the place where human beings are made of electrical rhythm. And he stops. She gathers a few things from the room. Money she'd stashed in a spot under the windowsill. A few bucks, enough for now. A battery radio Mrs. Montgomery Taylor had had as a girl and had given her in one of those moments of kindness that served to cloud over and obscure even the simple purity of suffering. She leaves her phone, because she's heard those things can be traced. She glances at the little ivory Christ impaled on a mahogany cross on the wall at the head of her bed. "Take it," says the voice.
"Have I done well?"
says Ally.
"Are you proud of me?"
"Oh, so proud, daughter. And you will make me prouder yet. You will do wonders in the world."
Ally thrusts the little crucifix into her duffel bag. She has always known she must never tell anyone about the voice. She's good at keeping secrets. Ally looks at Mr. Montgomery Taylor one last time before she levers herself out of the window. Perhaps he didn't know what hit him. She hopes he did. She wishes she could have sent him alive into the scalding tank. She thinks, as she drops down from the trellis and crosses the back lawn, that maybe she should have tried to filch a knife from the kitchen before she left. But then she remembers, and the thought makes her laugh, that aside from cutting her dinner, she really has no need for a knife. No need at all.